Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. Now, today I want to look at an essay by Richard J. Evans on Berlin in the 1920s. And, excuse me, one of the reasons why I want to do that is because there are some interesting things to be said about these kinds of historical intersections between time period and place. There are numerous examples if you look at, New York in the 1970s. The combination of cultural, political, and economic change creates this very vibrant, extremely violent, crisis-ridden city, of which there's an awful lot to discuss and some fascinating realizations to come of that. And Berlin is a city like no other in the 1920s. Not only after the end of the First World War, had a modern Berlin been kind of reborn in a way, almost certainly as the result of the revolution that unseated the Kaiser and created the Weimar government and a modern constitution, however flawed, that did offer people new rights and freedoms that they had never experienced under the Kaiserreich. It was a city that was at the cutting edge of the avant-garde of modernity. It was the most exciting and vibrant place for bohemians from Christopher Isherwood to Robert Capa to gravitate to towards the during the 20s and 30s. And it was really at the centre of big aesthetic and political movements. And it would unfortunately and tragically be Nazism that would win out. However, Berlin and Nazism have a very kind of fraught relationship with one another. To give you an example of this, it was the mission of Goebbels by Hitler to really go and bring Berlin to heel as Hitler's Nazi propagandist before the Nazis came to power. His mission to go and kind of win the city over to Nazism prior to that, it's referred to by the Nazis as Red Berlin. It is the epicentre of worker activism and trade union and Marxist politics. Okay, so without further ado, let's just read a little bit from Berlin in the 20s, by Richard J. Evans. This is from the brilliant book, The Third Reich in History and Memory. For liberals and leftists in Germany, Berlin has always represented the dark side of German history. Capital of the military state of Prussia, it became the grandiose centre and symbol of the Reich, founded by Bismarck in 1871. Always culturally stuffy, conservative, dull, backward, dominated by civil servants and soldiers. No wonder when they established the Democratic Republic following the revolution that overthrew the Kaiser after Germany's defeat in the First World War, the victorious liberals and social democrats sought to distance themselves symbolically from holding the Constituent Assembly in the provincial town of Weimar, even forever associated with the name of Germany's greatest poets Goethe and Schiller. Weimar was, of course, far from the revolutionary turbulence and street fighting that was raging across the capital in the early months of 1920. But it was also far from its associations with a past that they wanted to reject. It took a while for Berlin to lose those associations. Before the First World War, modernist culture had flourished everywhere. Elsewhere, I beg your pardon. Above all, in the Bavarian capital, Munich, in South Germany, with artists like Vasily Kandinsky, Alexei von Jelavinsky, Franz Marc and August Mack, pioneering abstract and semi-abstract paintings in the group they clubbed Der Blaue Reiter, or the Blue Rider. With radical clubs and cabarets, little socialist or anarchist meetings, and left-wing writers and playwrights flourishing in the Schwabing, the bohemian quarter of the town, Munich's equivalent to Paris's Left Bank. So what is being argued here is that Berlin was the unlikely home of the avant-garde in the 1920s, and the unlikely home of the of revolutionary politics. However, what happens is that there is this kind of strange inversion, where Munich, instead of being the home of liberal thinking, small anarchist and socialist newspapers, and avant-garde art, becomes the basis of reactionary politics in Germany. Really, it is the hometown of the Nazis. Why? Well, this has a lot to do with the fact that it was the home of the Ratte Republic. The Ratte Republic was the revolutionary socialist republic in 1919 that was violently crushed by the Freikorps. The end of the Bavarian monarchy at the end of the First World War and the brief seizure of power of Kurt Eisner, who was assassinated by a right-wing terrorist, led to the rule in the Ratte Republic of firstly Ernst Toller, then Eugen Levin, two far more extreme figures who brought a far more Leninist, violent, Bolshevik dictatorship to Bavaria. It didn't last long. In the spring of 1919, the Social Democrats in Berlin crushed the Republic with the Freikorps, and the communist regime in the Republic was murdered in a violent bloodbath. And in the aftermath, not only had left politics discredited themselves completely in Bavaria when the Ratte Republic started executing hostages, that really was the end for the avant-garde on the left there. And also, it meant that the crackdown had killed off anybody who proposed these sorts of ideas anyway. They'd either fled, been imprisoned, or been executed. So it meant that Bavaria and Munich particularly was kind of ground zero for right-wing politics. It was a place where right-wing ideas, extreme nationalist ideas, could be expressed without any hindrance. The situation is different in Berlin the following year, when the right-wing journalist Wolfgang Kapp seized power temporarily with the Freikorps and was brought down by a German civil service general strike. The trade unionists brought Berlin to a standstill, and the Freikorps and Kapp lose their nerve and flee. Until democratic rule can be quickly restored. So what that represented was a victory for the forces of kind of progressive thought, liberalism, intellectualism, and socialism, and it represented a in Munich completely the opposite. So in a funny way, these two cities kind of invert themselves culturally and politically in the 1920s. So the atmosphere in Munich is repressive, it is conservative, the Social Democrats even don't get much of a look in there. There is the threat of military action unless a right-wing cabinet that was led by Gustav Ritter von Kahr is introduced. The Kahr was backed by the army and by the police and by the centre-to-right Catholic Conservative Bavarian People's Party. Obviously, in Germany's south, you get a far greater Catholic population, closer you get to Austria. And one of the figures who obviously backed von Kahr was Adolf Hitler, who later decided to have, who attempted to overthrow Kahr or to corrupt Kahr at gunpoint during the Munich Putsch, and who later had Kahr assassinated during the Night of the Long Knives. And it was with Gustav Ritter von Kahr's tacit approval that Munich was able to become this centre of reaction. Right-wing groups were able to flourish, and given what Hitler had planned for him eventually, it was perhaps a rather poor judgment. So, Richard J. Evans writes, "Cultural radicalism banished from Munich by the counter-revolutionary clampdown relocated to Berlin. Throughout the 1920s, the national capital became a byword for artistic experimentation, anti-authoritarianism, radicalism and hedonism of every variety. It became a magnet for foreigners looking for urban adventure. Celebrated by Christopher Isherwood in his novels Mr. Norris Changes Trains and Goodbye to Berlin, subsequently transmuted into the movie Cabaret. Crime, murder and gangsterism was celebrated in popular culture and transformed into art by the paintings of George Grosch, the novel Berlin Alexanderplatz by Alfred Döblin, and the songs of Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht in the Threepenny Opera. Café life and cabaret flourished as they had done in Munich's Bohemian Schwabing district before the war." One of the interesting things to note is that many of the kind of the conventions of film noir and many of the early writings of detective or noir fiction begin in this period in 1920s Berlin. A lot of the directors, writers and producers fled the Nazis and went to Hollywood and were able to bring this kind of dark aesthetic with them that you can see echoed in popular culture throughout the 20th century. So Berlin's political magazines, satirical magazines and periodicals flourished throughout this period. And also, there were interesting developments in gender politics, women's rights, and sexual liberation. There was, naked cabaret and that sort of thing, and a dramatic increase in the sort of, not so much the acceptability, but the openness of prostitution. There was an interesting and in many ways tragic interplay between the development of sexual liberation in Berlin and also the increase in sexual exploitation. And this strengthens Nazi arguments throughout the period that Berlin has become immoral and Berlin has become corrupted. It's become the morals of Berliners have become corrupted. Obviously, there is all sorts of kind of anti-Semitic assertions throughout this, that somehow this is the work of the Jews or, Jewish pimps or prostituting Aryan women and all this sort of anti-Semitic kind of lies. But the truth was as well that for many ordinary Germans who had fonder memories of the Kaiserreich, Berlin seemed unrecognisable. And this change, this transition into a new Weimar democracy with new politics, new economics, a rapidly changing society, and now also new cultural values, is far too much of a transition for a great many Germans who find the world around them changing at a bewildering pace and mostly not to their liking.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
So, Richard J. Evans writes, viewed from Bavaria's centre of order in post-revolutionary Munich, Berlin in the 1920s seemed the very negation of the kind of military conservative traditional Germany to which the nationalists and authoritarians aspired. In most cultures and at most times, there is a lure back to the past. There is a desire for an imagined, simpler, easier time when people were better behaved, and that an authority was respected and things somehow worked. And this is particularly prevalent after a period of national crisis, such as that which Germany had endured before and after the First World War. During the war, Hitler was sent to recuperate in Berlin and thought it was a wonderful place. He wrote that it was a real metropolis. And he had thought it would be the place that an overthrow of Weimar democracy could begin from. He was in touch with the instigators of the Kapp-Putsch and went to Berlin, flew to Berlin when the Kapp-Putsch broke out. But when he got there, he was met by striking workers who occupied Berlin Airport. Disguised with a false stick-on beard, and he passed himself off as an accountant, Hitler managed to sort of get through the checkpoint somehow, but it was clear to him that even as he was leaving the airport, that the putsch had already failed. And it had been defeated by the workers, and so in his view, been defeated by socialism or kind of Judeo-Bolshevism, as Hitler would probably have thought. Perhaps it's that point that Hitler's loathing for Berlin, not just for what Berlin had become, but for Berliners, for being, in his view, weak or unwilling to support the national cause. At that point, it began. His loathing for the city began. He stated that the Berlin of Frederick the Great has been turned into a pigsty by the Jews. Munich, in contrast, Hitler thought, was pure and had been purified by the Freikorps, and the un-German elements of it had been wiped out. There's always some interesting linguistics when you look at Nazism. The idea of the country being sick, or the country being a body, or the race being a body, and having this kind of bacterium, this bacillus, this germ inside it, which was Judaism. The ability of the Nazis to continue adopting these kind of medicalized tropes is all the way to the end of the war, I think is really interesting. In some ways, the way in which leading perpetrators of the Holocaust thought about what they were doing was that they were cleansing the racial body. It's no accident that doctors selected the who would live and who would die, or who would die immediately and who would die slowly, at Auschwitz on the at the selection ramp, because those SS doctors were believed that the patient really was Germany or perhaps even Europe. As Germany descended into chaos in the mid 1920s, Hitler used all sorts of similar kind of language about Berlin. That Berlin was sick. It was degenerate. It had quite literally caught a disease. It had caught the diseases of modernity and cosmopolitanism and socialism and any other ism that Hitler didn't like, all of which he believed were traceable back to the Jews. So Hitler switches his seat of revolution to Munich. Munich would be the pure place by 1923, when the Munich Putsch began. That would be the kind of the politically and culturally cleansed place from which a national revolution to cleanse German society would begin from. That was how he would save Berlin. And the example that he draws from, obviously, from the previous year, was Mussolini's March on Rome. Where the mere threat of taking paramilitaries to Rome had caused the king to appoint Mussolini as prime minister. Another parallel that Hitler drew, another example that Hitler drew, was that of Mustafa Kemal, or later Kemal Atatürk, in Turkey. And how he established the new capital of Ankara. Richard J. Evans writes, the Turkish nationalist revolution of Mustafa Kemal had abandoned Constantinople and created a new unsullied capital far away in Ankara. In Turkey, Hitler declared at his trial for treason after the failure of the Beer Hall Putsch, salvation could not come from the rotten core in Constantinople. Just as in our case, the city was contaminated by democratic, pacifist, internationalised people, meaning, of course, Jews. So in Germany, there was a battle of ideas raging between those who existed in cities like Berlin, who were outward-looking, interested in new ideas, interested in developments in culture and politics and science and philosophy, and more inward-looking, backward-looking, parochial, traditionalist people who believed not only that Germany was changing beyond all recognition, but who also believed that there were culprits behind all of this, and that the Jews were always and everywhere trying to bring about a change that would destroy somehow the German people. And this is an easy thing to spin to people who are bewildered by the pace of change and frightened by it, and who need a kind of a demon figure to point at. So anti-Semitism found its roots or found kind of fertile ground in Germany during this period of time due to the pace of change. Now, obviously, the idea that Jews were somehow behind modern art and that this was kind of a harmful conspiracy against traditional pastoral painting loving Germans is laughable. But there were just enough Jewish artists, intellectuals, writers, thinkers. There were people such as the Frankfurt School of Social Research with Adorno, people like Eric Fromm and Herbert Marcuse, and all these kinds of figures, to try to make this accusation stick. There were many Jews amongst the Weimar Republic. But also, you have to remember that that Jews made up a tiny, tiny percentage, 0.5% of the entire German population. And therefore, across the avant-garde scene and the radical political scene in Germany, there were countless non-Jewish figures. Now, the argument that Hitler always put across was, well, you know, they've just been deluded and tricked and lied to by the Jews into endorsing all these non-German ideas. Either that, or they're going along with it willingly and they're traitors. That sort of kind of endlessly self-reinforcing reactionary thought was prevalent, not just from Hitler himself. Throughout the rest of the 1920s, there is a battle by Goebbels, about 1925 onwards, to reclaim Berlin for what he viewed as being the kind of traditional values of the German people, or those values that the Nazi Party now trumpeted. And there was a decision yet to be made within the minds of the Nazis as to whether Berlin was redeemable, whether Berlin could be saved. It seems curious that from the early 1930s onwards, Hitler's plans to establish a new city, really on the rubble of the old one, once he had his war, the city of Germania, were kind of coming to fruition in his mind. Just before the war, and in the early years of the war, the first kind of buildings of Germania start to be established. And obviously the plan ends with Hitler looking at a scale model of it in his bunker while Soviet shells rain down on the Reich Chancellery. But I always think that Germania itself indicates that perhaps Hitler believed that Germany, Berlin, was irredeemable, and it would perhaps be better to allow a war to raise it to the ground and then build some neoclassical imperium in its place. This, I think, in the corners of Hitler's imagination was what was really being considered. We shall never know. Anyway, thanks very much for listening, and if you can support the podcast via Patreon, that would be very helpful. Obviously, we rely on a tiny trickle of ad revenue and the generosity of some of our patrons. Thanks very much. All the best. Bye-bye.